Welcome to the Passive Mobile Home Park Investing Podcast with your host, Andrew Keel. This is the podcast where you can get the education you need to invest 100% passively in the highly profitable niche of mobile home parks.
Welcome to the Passive Mobile Home Park Investing Podcast. This is your host, Andrew Keel, and today we have a special guest in Mr. Jordan Nodell of Nodell Parks on the show. Before we dive in, I want to cut a deal with you. If you get more than $500 of value out of this episode, would you mind heading over to wherever you listen to podcasts at and leave this podcast a review? It should take 30 seconds or so, and it means the world to me. Thanks for taking the time to do that. All right, let's dive in. Jordan Nodell, based in Michigan, is a principal at Nodell Parks, which has a portfolio of over 40 mobile home communities across 10 states, including a portfolio in Alaska. Jordan, welcome to the show.
Hi, nice to be here.
Yeah, I was wondering if you wouldn't mind by starting out and just kind of telling us your story and, you know, how you got into, you know, mobile home park ownership and investing.
My story is the second generation of Nodell Parks. My father, Richard, started the company, but really he just started buying parks one by one in the 80s. I don't think he envisioned it as a company, but now in hindsight, we'll say he founded the company. I, by education and training, was an attorney. I am an attorney still, but I was practicing law in New York at a big firm doing complex civil litigation, nothing to do with real estate, nothing that totally prepared me for real estate. Had I known I would go into the field, it wasn't a plan of mine. I'm not saying that was good or by design. It just wasn't. I was working hard. I had a good experience at the law firm. It was probably invaluable for what I was able to bring in joining my father. But one day when he was visiting me in New York and I had some precious minutes, non-billable minutes to have lunch with him, I was saying, Dad, you have grown a business brick by brick. You have ownership and equity in it. You kind of steer your own ship and have a nice life, and you have meaningful impact on employees and residents in your properties. And I'm working really hard for a lot of other people's interests. And my dad said to me, yeah, but you're an attorney and a big firm. And, you know, why do you want to go to mobile home parks? And I said, well, what I just said about your life. And he said, come to think of it, I guess I do have it really nice. And so he kind of made the proposal to me of sorts that if I wanted to come back to Michigan where I grew up and shadow him, he said, I imagine after a year or two of just listening to me, you'll know, you know, or at least have enough judgment to make the decisions I make. Let me know if you want to do that. So I thought on it for a few months and decided that though I hadn't necessarily intended to give up law and go into manufactured housing, the ability to steer my own ship, so to speak, to grow, add value to the company, do more deals, to travel to properties to see them or to oversee our operations was something very attractive. And so I jumped into that. It was about 10 years ago. It was at a time when I first learned from my dad to quickly value a deal, look at the current income, make a few minor adjustments, and put an 8 or 9 cap on that and make that offer to the owner. And it actually sort of worked at the time, although now the cap we put on that income is much lower. Obviously, in hindsight, I would have done a lot more deals starting in 2013 when I joined, and especially those early years, a lot more deals that I did. But, you know, so be it. With hindsight, I can only look at the deals that I have to look at today. But that's how he did it. The company and my father's approach was building a real estate portfolio, really deal by deal. Never did he take on or have we taken on a fund because we didn't want the pressure to have to allocate capital. A fund has a lot of advantages, especially in certain deal environments. I know it advantages some groups now, but we had always chosen our deals very carefully for a group of close family and friend investors, mostly friends, not family, but we call them friends and family. They are like family at this point. We have now the children and even grandchildren of initial investors calling us for deals. And so as the ownership of Nodell Parks is growing generationally, so are our investors. It's a good fit. We still go deal by deal. If we have a new deal under contract, we show our investors. They're hungry for them. It doesn't take a lot of convincing because our results speak for themselves. Sometimes I think we should buy more, although I remind myself our careful approach to buying good deals and running them well has served us. It's allowed us to sleep well at night. And as someone once told me, there is no price you can put on sleeping well at night. So if that's how it's going, I should appreciate it. I'm not sure how some of these groups that seem to buy anything that they're offered are able to deal with the stress, but I think carefully choosing deals is important.
Totally. Yeah. Thank you for that background. I think you have a different outlook than a lot of newer syndicators, right? Being that second generation, maybe you can touch on that and maybe share a little bit about that generational outlook and kind of how does that affect things, right? If you're refinancing something for maybe the second time or the third time, you know, what type of debt are you keeping on these assets? Do you have any debt on them? You know, do you want them to be free and clear? You know, what does that look like?
That hasn't been part of our strategy. In terms of how we do deals, it probably doesn't differ a whole lot from how anyone else would invest in real estate, which is to try and have your equity sources be dependable and close by, but use debt leverage to do as big a deals or as many as you can. And so nowadays with interest rates and pricing and cap rates, things are a little different. But up until very recently, we kind of had a plain vanilla approach. We would, you know, get leverage on 75% of the purchase price, raise the down payment, and then a reserve fund and closing costs in equity. And we would take long-term debt, probably for 10 years. Like many, we used to have great relationships with CMBS lenders, which over the past decade kind of merged or changed into agency financing. So there's 10-year fixed debt. Our plan was never to sell quickly, so 10-year fixed debt was not a problem. And almost always, when the debt was maturing, we would refinance, hopefully return a nice amount to our investors, and they were very happy about that, while at the same time continuing to own and cash flow the properties.
How much leverage, you know, upon a refinance are you guys taking on? Is it a full 75%, you know, loan to value?
We would typically take what we could, 70%, let's say. We would do some analysis. We don't want to, you know, unnecessarily leverage a deal if we don't have to. We try not to be greedy, but if we can return investors money and then a little while taking on new debt that still allows us to cash flow, that's a good position.
I think my biggest question revolves around like pushing revenue, right? And NOI growth, you know, from a generational outlook. While your father, you know, got into this in the 80s, and then now you getting into this back in 2013, you know, how have you guys been able to push NOI, and has the theory of, hey, 5 to 10% rent bumps every year, has that played out, you know, since the 80s with minimal turnover, given how low market lot rents, you know, typically are?
We like to buy in areas of growth and jobs. We don't really have a rural portfolio. They're in cities. We don't have any special economic forecasting for which city is necessarily a whole lot better than another. But in any town of 50, 100,000 or more that, you know, has decent economics, there's a need for affordable housing. So we've always started with, you know, the premise that affordable housing, good affordable housing, is in need. And if it's in need, then nominal rent increases are always supportable. We are not a company that has done day one $100 rent increases ever. When we own parks, hopefully forever, so to speak, we don't have that kind of need or pressure to do that. We do want to add value to the park, fix any issues, make it a little nicer for folks. And then I think there's an inherent justification for for normal rent increases.
Modest. Yeah. Yeah.
For modest
rent increases, you know, for sure.
So that's what we've done. Now, I wouldn't say there's entirely special sauce to our operations other than having the patience to know that if we buy something that's a good asset or has potential to be a good asset and we're going to operate it ourselves, which we do, we manage everything ourselves for a long time, then we can let things play out. And that's, I think, the healthiest for the economics of a deal, because there's not that year one or day one pressure.
Yeah.
It keeps our residents happiest and our turnover is pretty low. It keeps our managers happy. They're able to feel good about their jobs and also see residents that are happy. We have a lot of really long-term managers, folks that have been with us 10 or 20 years.
Wow.
And we rely on them for whatever we can't be in the field ourselves. So I think this kind of approach to operations serves us well economically. We do same thing anyone else does. We look for opportunities to add value and deliver great returns to our investors. If utilities aren't being sub-metered, we're not geniuses for realizing that that's something that probably should be done, especially if rents or the overall package to residents is below market, which often it is. If there's a dilapidated playground or the pool's been closed for years and it doesn't take a ton of money to fix it, that's something nice to do when we're the new owners. And then people appreciate where we're taking things.
Oh, totally, Jordan. And what do you think is like the toughest hurdle, in mobile home park investing? Like, looking at the whole portfolio, what would you say is the hardest part?
Nowadays, it's competing against folks that have a shorter term outlook on their investment, who are increasing rents tremendously in the first year, who are looking to implement all of their value add ideas immediately, and then maybe get out more quickly than us. It's part of the game. It might be fine to do and might actually work out for a lot of folks. It makes it a little more challenging for us. Although, again, if those folks can come and go, we want to own good parks forever. We still, in this environment where I've never seen things so expensive with interest rates also so high, and the inability to highly leverage deals because of that, we still find a few deals a year. We found a few deals a year when, not many people wanted parks. We find a few good deals a year now that everyone wants them. I guess when you don't have the pressure under you of a fund or a short-term outlook, you could do a few deals a year and be very happy. And now where we own around 40 parks all across the nation, that's a pretty good portfolio to have.
That is. And how many pads is that?
It's around 9,000 pads.
Wow, that's fantastic. That's a really nice portfolio.
And also I'll say there's a lot of small parks out there that are great for folks getting involved, and people can add a lot of value to those properties and make them nicer. Our parks tend to be bigger. Just doing the math, I guess our average size would be like 200, 250 pads. I mean, we do have some smaller parks under 100 units. We have some very large ones, 600 units. We like the big stuff because it allows us to do nice things at scale.
Yeah, maybe talk on that. Like, what does that criteria, the size is obviously important. Will you look at private utilities? What's your secret, buying criteria?
It sounds somewhat conservative. Bigger, nicer areas on hopefully public utilities. But we make exceptions to everything, and often every deal has one exception that we made, and that's how we're able to find a deal or do well. I will say I'm about at three strikes and you're out. I'm making that exception to sewer plants. Unfortunately, they are a pain and take up most of our management time for those particular parks. Private water, not such a big deal. Those aren't that big a deal, but bigger parks, it's not even that it has to be 600 pads. It could be 70 pads or 50. If it looks like a community or looks like it can be made into a community, that's something we like.
More like a subdivision type of look, not a beat up kind of ratty looking trailer park. You're not doing that kind of heavy
lift. That's right. Those beat up ratty things on the side of the freeway, I mean, they deserve to be made nice too. So I don't I'm not looking down on that, but I want to take something where you can create some community sense, not just be pressing the guy that's got a raggedy lot and a raggedy home for more money. I'd like to do something. We get our managers, we give them a lot of autonomy. We don't tell them exactly what to do. We say, you know, do a back to school event, do a Thanksgiving event, do something that gives people a sense of community where they're living.
Yeah, I love that. That's great. What are the most important things, like if you were going to invest passively into another mobile home park operator's, you know, another GP's deal, what are the most important things you would look out for before investing money with that other syndicator?
Investing in cash flowing real estate is a more slow and steady proposition. This isn't venture capital. Don't look for huge multiples and grand slams. Find an operator that's buying quality products, quality assets, and running them well, and that has a longer term perspective. And you'll probably get a decent return.
That's good.
Keep it unsexy, and you know, you'll probably be better served in the long run than someone promising a three-figure rent increase and a massive turnaround and an exit in year three that assumes cap rates will necessarily be so low or that interest rates will remain so low as they didn't. Then I think operators and investors get themselves in trouble or don't quite realize their expectations.
Okay. Yeah. No, that makes sense. What does the perfect mobile home park look like in your eyes and why?
The perfect park in terms of buying one is something that has some stability and some upside. I think that's probably anyone would agree with that proposition. Stability in terms of it being a existing community that has functioned fairly well, and maybe the owner just didn't have the resources to fill up all the spaces. Maybe the owner wasn't as comfortable with rental homes or didn't have such solid relationships with manufacturers or dealers to fill up the park, or didn't have the management platform to oversee a leasing manager and a maintenance guy. So, you know, if enough was there that we could turn that around, but still the owner can show some steady income year over year, we're happy to bet a little bit on upside and make a very strong offer, knowing that we can probably go a little more quickly in filling up occupancy. We can probably do a little better in spotting obvious needs of improvement, whether it's the roads or infrastructure or just some basic amenities. That's kind of our ideal. I would love to find a deal. Most of our deals we did find like this, less so these days, but where it's stable enough to attract the best kind of financing, and yet has 15% vacancy, so that we can say year one, we're going to bring in 20 homes or 30 homes and get those all leased up. And then we have an even bigger park. Park-owned homes has been a major component of our growth. And again, to speak a little
straight
bit
about rentals, park-owned homes.
Straight rentals or, you know, rent credit hybrids, whatever it is to give someone a sense that they're in a home that is better than where they were living. I think that, you know, whether it's a rental or whether it's rent to own or a sale, if someone's in a place that is better than where they came from and they like where they're living, in what they're living in, then I think they're going to want to stay as long as you don't make it, you know, too bad or screw it up for them. So we have very low turnover. We tend to increase occupancy and not have a lot of people leaving. So our trick is just to get the homes in quickly. About during the recession, it was a little bit before I came on board, but my father, as he explains it, and he still works with me when he's not chilling out in Florida. Mm-hmm. I still discuss every deal with him, though, so I want to give him credit. But I said, what'd you do then? He said, well, I went to my investors. I said, the recession's bad. People are losing their homes. There's folks picking off homes. I need a fund. We need to raise cash, and we're going to buy the homes, and we're going to rent them out to the folks so that they don't leave our property. People, it's recession. People still need the home, and they're going to try and hold on to their home as long and as much as they can. So let's just buy more homes and offer it to them. The investors asked a lot of questions because the park-owned home business was not really part of the real estate play back then. It is more now. But they said, okay, seems to make sense. And I do think we were one of the early groups to quickly pivot towards offering homes and being in the homes business. And it's not something we're that afraid of now. I mean, it can constrain stuff because lenders don't love it and there's other issues and it's more intensive. But frankly, being in the business of also providing and maintaining the home is okay. We make money doing it. It's part of our management structure. I think that's been one area where we were quick to not shy from, and it did us well.
That's great. Yeah, that you guys were able to pivot like that. One thing I wanted to touch on, just real quick, if you don't mind, is just your portfolio is pretty spread out. I mean, from Alaska to South Carolina, Oklahoma, Michigan, Alabama. You know, I guess if you have a tip or, it seems like it would be very tough to manage, you know, being that spread out. Yeah, maybe you can just speak on that for a second.
Well,
I guess the scale.
And we are from Alaska down to Alabama and a lot of places in between. So you're right. I don't think there's any of our parks where you can't fly to a major airport and get to within 2 hours, if not less. I get that Detroit to Anchorage is far, but so it's an airplane ride and a short drive. And I'm able to see all our properties hopefully every year. Certainly the folks on our core operations team are seeing them every year. At the time when my father originated some of the Alaska deals, folks said, "Him, Alaska, whoa." And said, "Yeah, see, there's Anchorage has a few hundred thousand people and a major airport, and it's a few more hours of flying time. That's about it. There's people there just like anywhere that need homes." So I don't see that as an impediment. We have, like I had alluded to, very long-term dedicated employees, both on the ground and then now also at our corporate side. So through being on the ground as much as possible, talking to these folks every day, the geographic location isn't such a big deal. As I said, though, we're in cities, so it's not that we're... If ever I have to figure out too much where something is, like, is that a real city or next to a real city or far from a place you'd ever want to be or heard of, then it may not be the deal for us. Anchorage, Oklahoma City, Birmingham, Alabama, all great spots. I enjoy personally spending time in those cities, visiting our parks there. We'll go to where there's a deal. And we look around the states we're in because we have some knowledge there, but I love new states. It's been a little while since we've been to a new state. Alabama and South Carolina were our most recent new states, but I hope to do more deals in more states because that's a great aspect of the business. And there is something universal.
Yeah.
There's always hardworking people that need affordable housing. So, it doesn't have to be such a regional thing.
That's good. Jordan, what do you think is the biggest threat to mobile home park investing right now?
I think it's folks in the business for quick money that have little concern for the assets they're actually purchasing and the people who are living in. We're in it to make money. I'm not acting like it's altruistic. We're not a government entity. There should be those for, other kind of supported housing, not here. We're in it to make money, but it doesn't mean we need to take advantage of our customers. And I do think that nowadays, a lot of folks are, as I say, stuck in their spreadsheets, convince themselves that a number makes sense and that anything is possible, and then are suddenly surprised when some legislatures are taking up the idea of rent control. I think rent control is misguided, and a lot of the state, so-called unfriendly acts to landlords are very misguided, and I join the fight against them. But also, let's be honest, how we got here. Folks that buy a park with no plan to meaningfully fix it up, think in their heads or on their spreadsheets that rents are $200 below market, and say that day one, let's pass through that increase. I think that's very short-sighted. I don't know what to say. All I can say is don't be surprised when, you know, the city council member calls or someone talks to the news about you. And so I, you know, our investors, every time there's an article in the newspaper, Ford does, do you see this? And I say, yes, it's too bad. It's not how we operate our parks. I'm equally concerned about rent control or some of these other initiatives. I you know, there should be standards. I mean, we're buying property, we're buying housing. We should be held to certain standards. I think that's a danger to our industry.
Thank you for sharing that, Jordan. If any of our listeners would like to get a hold of you, what's the best way for them to do so?
Check out our website, nodelparks.com, NodelParks.com. First off, you can see a map of where all our parks are. The photos are all real residents. I can promise you that. There's no stock imagery on our site. And you can contact us, and I will most likely personally see that email, or someone will be able to respond if you're looking to get in touch. I would welcome everyone to check out our site and learn more about our company. I'm certainly proud of it and how we've grown and what we're doing.
That's fantastic. Before we sign off, Jordan, what's one last bit of, you know, important advice you would give an interested passive mobile home park investor, you know, just before we sign off here?
If you're passive and you're putting your money with someone else to run with, make sure you trust them and that their business plan makes sense to you. So when I look at deals and the broker says there's a lot of value to be added, that plan has to make sense to me. If it doesn't feel right, it probably isn't. If you go with your gut, you trust the person, you like the deal too. You don't need to know a ton about mobile home parks or about a city in a particular state, but if the things seem right, and you have a longer-term patient perspective, you'll probably be nicely rewarded.
Awesome. Thanks again for coming on the show, Jordan.
Thanks. This was fun.
That's it for today, folks. Reminder, please leave a review if you got value out of the show. Thank you all so much for tuning in.
Hey, are you getting value out of this show? If so, would you mind please going over to iTunes and leaving the show a quick 5-star review? I have a goal of hitting over 100 5-star reviews by the end of 2021, and it would mean the absolute world to me if you could help contribute to that. Thanks ahead of time for making my day with your 5-star review of the show.